What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
I'm Scott Wapner, and you're listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast, the most profitable hour of the trading day. We record this live weekdays at 12 Eastern. Listen in.
Welcome to the Halftime Report. I'm Scott Wapner. Front and center this hour, the mounting risks for your money as stocks pace for their fourth down week in a row. We debate the keys to this market right now with our investment committee. And joining me for the hour today are Josh Brown, Jim Labenthal, John Najarian, Kerry Firestone is the CEO of Aureus Asset Management, and Amy Raskin's here as well, the chief investment officer of Chevy Chase Trust. Let's go to the wall. Like we always do, take a look at stocks. We are watching tech as always. NASDAQ 100 is on track for its worst month since November 08. We're up about 1%, and we've been all over the map today. But, Jim, I want to focus on a couple of things that you did in the market today. You bought Walmart. You bought Microsoft. Why are you putting money to work in those stocks right now?
Yeah, well, first off, why am I putting money to work? And then I'll get to those stocks. We've had a 10% correction as of this morning's open in the S&P 500. Scotty, you know that I've held cash for a little while. I'm not the only one. I've been waiting for a correction. Here it is. I can't sit here and say I'm not going to do anything when I get the correction. I still have some cash. But look, for this to get worse than a correction, and maybe it goes down 12, 13%, I don't know, but for it to get worse, you have to think that the Fed is ineffective, and you have to think that all the cash on the sidelines, which we know is there from mutual fund and ETF flows, isn't going to come flooding in. And frankly, I think it is going to start coming in. Otherwise, you're predicting the end of the world. In 42 years of investing, I have yet to see the world end. Now, you asked why these two stocks. These are high-quality companies. I want some retail exposure. I don't have much. I'm certainly not going to go with a value play and pick up something like Macy's. I don't think we have to waste our breath on that. I could buy Amazon, but I'm still having a hard time with the valuation. Walmart has a good mixture of brick and mortar with online presence, trades at about 24 times forward earnings, and in this interest rate environment, that's cheap, has a PEG ratio of about 2.0. I'm on board with that. Microsoft, look, it's got many pistons in the engine, whether it's Azure, whether it's the operating system, whether it's gaming, and now I'm getting it at 30 times earnings. Again, for this quality of growth, and you see it in the PEG ratio, which is 2.2, a 30 times multiple is absolutely reasonable.
Okay.
So I've nibbled here. I still have some cash, about 8%, Scotty.
Yeah, but the fact that, Kerry, he's putting money to work suggests that he thinks the worst of the correction is behind us. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that Jim stated correctly that at 10% down, and you have some names that have gone down quite a bit more than 10%. If you look at the drop in NASDAQ names, between 10 and 30% on some stocks. So, you have to pick your places, and you look at what your target buy and target sell is. So Jim acted. I think that a 10% correction in this environment where there's, uncertainty about the economy, about the virus and the election, I think that's reasonable. We went from 22 times forward earnings to something closer to 19, 19 and a half times in a very low interest rate environment. I don't think anybody can time the market so perfectly that we can pick the bottom or even pick the tops. But if you've got a point in mind that I like this stock at this price, and I think this is what I'm willing to pay for it, that's what investors should do. And that's something that Jim did, I think, appropriately. So I'm all for it.
So Josh, Tom Lee today says stocks may be pricing in the worst is yet to come. He's looking at 62% retrace of the rally since June. Would be a convenient place to price that in. That level is 3224. We're within a stone's throw of that. He views that level as one of the most important to watch. Where do you think we are?
So that's a really important question because the market is moving so fast these days. We could say something here at 12 o'clock that looks ridiculous at 2 o'clock. And you know, one thing that I find interesting, there's been so much emphasis about big cap tech over and over again. Look at the Qs. They're down 20 basis points on the week based on where they're trading right this moment. So they've barely actually done anything this week. In the meanwhile, energy is just being liquidated, not sold, liquidated. The XLE names are down 12% on the week, and it's only Thursday. The cruise lines and the cruises and the airlines are down pretty much almost all of them, more than 4% today. The Jets ETF for the airliners is down more than 10% on the week. So, yeah, large cap tech had kind of a blow-off top and has been cooling off, but really those stocks are stabilizing here. Now, there are some pockets of very unhealthy trading. What do I mean by that? Look at the way Zoom has been behaving. Stock went straight up vertical for days and days, and then just quickly loses 8%. That's scary stuff, and there are some pockets where that kind of unhealthy activity is going on. I guess if you're a day trader, it's not unhealthy. It's very healthy, and you're enjoying it. But for investors in those names, they are being whipped around like crazy. But I would just point out, those are the exceptions. So I think a lot of eyes are focused on Apple and on Microsoft as two stocks that if the overall market is going to stabilize, maybe those stabilize first. And based on what I told you with the Qs this week and even the equal weight Qs, we might be seeing the early signs of that. So I like Jim's instinct, this idea that, all right, you said you're going to buy a dip. You said you're going to buy a dip. Here it is. You got down 10% from the highs very quickly. Buy the dip. So I think that's the right way to be feeling right now.
Okay. That's a fair assessment. And we do bring this up when people say, yes, I'm waiting for the dip. This dip is great. This is exactly what we're waiting for and we need. And then you don't put money to work when you get the dip. Jim is actually putting money to work when he got the dip. John, you bought more Apple this week at 105. Apple has to be a key to the market, right? 103 seems to be a key level to watch, according to traders. You're one of them, and you bought at 105.
Yeah, but Scott, and while that's all true, and like I say, I've been evening up my position in Apple, switching out of call spreads and back into the stock on this sell-off. But what I would also emphasize is that because of the outperformance of what Jim just bought, Microsoft, that has overtaken Apple now as my largest position. So that was pretty interesting to me that, you know, because just kind of watching the market, Scott, the way we do, I don't really watch on a tick-for-tick basis one stock against another. But in this case, the second largest holding I had, Microsoft, now has overtaken Apple as my largest position, not because of adds or subtracts in that space, but instead because Microsoft has done so much better over the short term. And maybe that outperformance continues, and I wouldn't be at all unhappy about it.
You think the worst is, I mean, it sounds like Josh and Jim are both saying that the worst may be over for this tech sell-off that we've seen. Do you think so, particularly when you talk about mega cap tech?
Well, Scott, I think I sent Prashant and the team a graph that showed that the peak, when we were 70-30, we'll have a vaccine by the end of the year. We hit the all-time high for the S&P, and that was basically beginning of September, just after Apple and Tesla were splitting and so forth. And then it's kind of meandered down towards a 50-50 deal. Will we have a vaccine by year end, at least one or more vaccines by year end? And as we've done that, I was listening to David Kostin today over at Goldman Sachs, and he was saying that's, you could plot that on a graph, how that has worked out to the downside once that went from a majority thinking we would have a vaccine to not having it. I think you put that together with the lack of stimulus, Scott, and if that same outlook prevailed, if we had no vaccine until 2021 and no stimulus at all, then I think the market could break these levels that it's hit. But it has bounced very strongly at exactly Tom Lee's levels, so I don't want to fade that. That's why I was comfortable adding to some Apple and, like I say, trading out of call spreads and into the stock, which I do when I think, you know, we get into that position.
But, Amy, what do we do with some of these other techs, which, you know, Cramer and some other folks think are still up too much? He mentions names like Okta, which is up 77% year to date. It's only down 5% this month, and there are so many other stocks within that universe, DocuSign and Fastly and Wayfair, which are up 200+% on the year and not down that much month to date. So the question then morphs from about mega cap tech to some of these high flying, high valuation techs, and do they need to come in more in their own right?
Probably, yes. I mean, generally speaking, we still think that the market is very overvalued. Valuation is a terrible timing tool, so it can continue to rise. But we think, given levels with market cap at a record percentage of GDP, forward PEs reaching bubble levels, generally we're moving more into cash. We continue to trim even after this 10% correction. From a long-term perspective, we think there's more downside. Remember, the bubble in 99 went further and higher than anyone thought for longer, but then corrected 50%. So some of the mega cap techs we've been trimming more aggressively. Just the law of large numbers, we think, is going to catch up with them at multi-trillion dollar valuations. It's hard to grow that fast. Soon you're going to take over the entire economy, and we just don't think that's feasible. So, and some of the pure COVID beneficiaries, we also think ran too far too fast. We think some of the names that you just mentioned, they're going to have incredibly hard comps next year. So we are actually staying away from the pure COVID beneficiaries, and as well as staying away from the companies that are in the direct line of COVID, the airlines and some other areas, and instead looking for companies that we think their business models are fundamentally changed and benefited by this pandemic.
So the other question I have for all of you, really, I think, is a substantial issue, because it's one that investors that I speak with, big investors, are talking about, and that is whether you all, investors, the public, the market, is just way too complacent still about the election, which is only 40 days away, right? The general news cycle today is focusing on the fact that the president won't commit to a peaceful transfer of power. Is that in the market? Does that get in the market at some point? Is the fact
Scott,
that if
can I take that?
Hold on, I'm not finished yet, though. I'll let you take it first. But the fact that if Biden wins, Democrats win the Senate, is that in the market at all? Does a different tax policy favor or factor into the market at all? If you have a higher corporate tax rate, a much higher capital gains rate, is that factored into the market? You're only 40 days away. Mm-hmm. Is election chaos factored into the market, Jim, in any way, shape or form?
I think it is. Let's use numbers and then let's use sentiment. Okay, numbers, if you look at the last 6 months, there's been $300 billion of outflows from equity mutual funds and ETFs. So, I mean, the public has, the investment community has been voting with its feet. But then let's also just talk about sentiment, because I had a discussion with a client this morning who's a dear friend, and he was about to say, hey, I'm scared. I want to go all to cash. And he said, this is unprecedented. The president might not leave the Oval Office, you know, all the things that were that you were kind of alluding to there. But the truth is, it always seems unprecedented. All right. The pandemic seemed unprecedented. The shutdown seemed unprecedented. The great financial crisis seemed unprecedented. And I'm saying all that because, again, in 42 years of investing, I have yet to see the world end. Some bad things may happen. And that's why the market is off 10%. Maybe it goes down to the 200-day moving average, another 4% lower. But you've got to realize that whatever bad things happen, the idea that the world is going to end is misplaced. The markets will grow again.
Why does it have to be an all or nothing?
Reach, whether it's
why does it have to be this all or nothing? I mean, the world's not going to end, but it could be rather chaotic for a period of time. The markets don't like uncertainty to begin with. This could be uncertainty on steroids. I'm surprised that you think
that's
that
why you
all
want
of,
to have.
I'm surprised that you suggest that all of the potential outcomes that I read out for you, you think is in the market.
Can I jump in on that one?
After Jim speaks on that, Amy, you can. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think there is probably support at the 200-day moving average, which is 3106, about 4% below where we are. We've seen the market bounce off of that twice in this rally. And there's certainly been things to fear in the last 6 months. We know that. I'm not saying that, by no means am I saying that I bottom ticked with my purchases today. And if I implied that, Scott, I didn't, you know, you'll be the first to disabuse me of that.
No,
I am
you
not
didn't
saying
imply
that
anything.
I or anyone can bottom
you,
tick.
You didn't imply yeah. anything. You explicitly said that you thought a potential chaos around the election is priced into the market. There was no implication. You explicitly said it. Are you taking it
yeah.
back?
Scott, look, I've said two things. One, I'm clearly putting money to work. But number two, nobody, including me, can bottom tick this and say this is the bottom. That's why I'm talking about the 200-day moving average, okay? At no point have I said right now is the bottom in the market. Is it a good time to buy? I think so. But I'm not saying this is the bottom. I can't say that. Nobody can say that. It's a good time to buy, though.
Amy?
Yeah, so on the election, I think there, you know, the range of outcomes is just so vast. It's very hard to discount. And remember, when in 2016, when Trump was elected, the financials just ripped. I mean, that was the sector to own. And that quickly dissipated in the following 3 years. So I do think you have to be sort of careful of the knee-jerk reaction to an exogenous event like this. We don't know what's going to happen. It's very hard to price in. I think generally speaking, you sort of go back to, you know, financial theory. Equity should represent the sum of their discounted cash flows. And we still have to come back to that mantra. And probably whatever happens is not going to change that too dramatically. Do you think if the capital gains tax goes up significantly, some of these big winners, there could be a rush out, a more aggressive rush out, so people locking in their gains and paying lower taxes. That's just a logical conclusion. But in general, I think, you know, politics doesn't have as big of an impact on fundamental investing as some people like to think.
Carrie?
We all expect there to be volatility through the election. You know, everyone does, and I think most people expect there to be definitely tax increases if the Democrats win. If you look at a table that Vanguard put together, and I think Vinny put this in a concise form, it shows that over a very long period of time, it's hard for me to believe that Vanguard got numbers from 150 years ago, but they seem to have. Markets have essentially been the same if Democrats win or Republicans win. I mean, these show that there's a slightly higher return annually if there's a Democratic president, but it's essentially the same. And that's over a long period of time, so we're not talking about the next month, 2 months, or 3 months. If there's a contested election, of course there's going to be trauma in the country and there'll be great volatility in markets, but that's not going to last. There will be a president. There's going to be someone in the White House. Maybe we should try it without a president for a while, perhaps, but I don't think that'll last for long. So I understand the concern that you have, clients have, everyone has about a contested election and violence and concern and political and social unrest. But the market is looking beyond that. I believe the way the market looked beyond it at the end of March and said, you know, now we're oversold and the market has to go up because things will get better. And, you know, that's what I believe that the numbers would show.
Well, I mean, let's be clear. The market didn't look through the pandemic, Carrie, at the end of March. The market was rescued.
Oversold.
In many respects.
Oversold.
Well, of course it was.
And the
may have been oversold.
And the Treasury.
But the only reason you could feel like it was oversold was because the Fed got involved to the degree which it did, along with the Treasury and everything else. Otherwise, how could we make that statement? John and Jerry.
Right, but that's, yeah.
Finish your thought, Carrie. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, not to be glib, but that's part of a healing process that the Fed and the Treasury step in with massive amounts of stimulus and support. It does something to the economy that is healing at the time where things were obviously getting much worse from the virus.
John?
Scott, just real quick, when we were at that all-time high, September 2nd or thereabouts, 3,508 or whatever it was, for the S&P, when we're there, I think you wouldn't be imprudent to put on a hedge into the election. After a 10% correction that we've seen, if you decide now, I think you're better off waiting a bit. And the reason, Scott, is number one, volatility popped way up. And just a week ago or so, it was in the 30s. In fact, just days ago, it was back in the 30s. And now it's popped back down under 29. And so, in other words, I think if you give it time, you're getting into something that, for a lot of us, is really deep end of the pool, short-term trading for, in particular, derivatives, Scott, like options that have massive time decay in that final 30 to 60 days. If people are trying to put on a hedge now after a 10% correction, you're almost guaranteeing yourself to lose money. If, like I say, if we were to float back up to a high, Scott, and because there's, I'm not saying that there's a guaranteed floor at a 10% correction. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is time decay will kill you as time goes by. We have a debate next Tuesday that might have a significant impact on how people feel about the markets and about the election. I'd say give it time after this correction rather than trying to slap on a protection right now and seeing that time decay just hammer you.
Josh, where do you come down on this issue of complacency? Because it's real from the people that I talk to are genuinely concerned about a level of complacency that's in the market, particularly around election outcomes.
Yeah, so I think Amy said something that's important about how stocks basically are meant to represent their cash flows and then finding a valuation discounted back. But the missing ingredient to that statement is the role that sentiment plays in the short term. And I agree, Scott, with the point that you're bringing up being important. And the surveys actually reflect that. It was an institutional investor survey last week that found more professional investors, asset management firms, et cetera, more of them are concerned with the coming election than are concerned with the virus, which is wild. But that is, I think, the next big sentiment-driving catalyst to come, and I think it's going to be profoundly negative. So in the short term, I do think we'll have chaos. I absolutely think that it's going to be a long, drawn-out fight. Even if it's clear that Trump wins the Electoral College, which I don't think it will be, I don't think Biden will be in a rush to concede. Al Gore didn't concede for 6 weeks, and what was different about that period of time in 2000 versus today, in that period of time, neither candidate was an incumbent. Now we have an incumbent who is publicly saying things like, the only way I could possibly lose is if it's rigged. He's already planting the seeds. He has absolutely no intention of leaving if he loses. We should take him at his word. And so I think it could be very ugly and it could drag on for way longer than it did in 2000.
So you don't think it's priced in?
And with an incumbent involved.
Jim thinks it's priced in.
No way. And with an incumbent involved, it gets even more complex because the president has powers and Bill Barr has powers and Mitch McConnell has powers, and they have demonstrated that they will use those powers to keep their guy exactly where they want him. So I would say it's not priced in. Now, here is the countervailing force that I think ultimately will stabilize the market. And by the way, we don't trade on politics. We don't invest based on who's going to be the president. And all the capital gains and corporate tax stuff you hear is nonsense. Ronald Reagan raised the capital gains tax from 21 to 28% in 1986. The stock market continued to boom for years afterward. Forget about all that stuff. The chaos will be sentiment driven more so than it will be fundamentally driven. But the countervailing forces that will help us are twofold. First, we will absolutely have an FDA approval on a vaccine at some point during that window of electoral chaos. That's A. And then B, buybacks have fallen off a cliff this year. I don't even think people understand the extent to which that leg of the stool has disappeared. We never talk about it. Buybacks were at an annualized rate of almost $1 trillion for 2020 in the midpoint of the first quarter of this year.
Okay.
And they have vanished. We're now doing less than $100 billion worth of buybacks in Q2.
Good.
I doubt that materially changed much in Q3, buybacks will return. And so the large cap techs that we talk about
right.
being important to the market as stabilizers, that's where that return of buybacks will show
I
up.
Want,
so
I, want,
I think we'll be okay.
I want to interrupt you. Forgive me for interrupting you, but you make a good point. And on that point, I want to bring up some information that we have about buybacks and about capital return plans and ask you all what you think about it, because a number of major companies have said they are resuming buybacks and or dividends recently. In September, and we're rolling the list here as they roll by Brunswick and Darden and Dick's Sporting Goods, Dollar General, Dollar Tree, Dunkin' Brands, Foot Locker, Guess, Johnson Controls, Kimberly-Clark, Kimco Realty, Lululemon, MetLife, raising dividends recently, General Mills, Microsoft, Verizon. So, Kerry, what do you make of this point that Josh is saying? This has been an absence in the market, and now even though it's just but a trickle, it may be coming back. Is that a bullish sign for stocks?
It's definitely a bullish sign. I mean, remember, when you talk about catalysts for the market going higher over the past decade, one of the major ones was buybacks. We have half the number of companies and fewer than half the number of shares available to buy than we did, you know, 15 years ago. And much of that is because of buybacks. So, you know, every time you reduce the supply, if the demand's there, it's going to help. I think that it's interesting the companies themselves and the sectors in which, you know, you talked about a number that were consumer, retail, manufacturing. You know, I suspect that if you go through the list, there'll be names where they think they're getting a bargain or something there has worked against their stock price. And that's what, to me, is reasonable for them to do if they have the available cash. You know, I wonder, though, if we get into a period, as Josh suggests, that there may be unrest and sentiment that negatively very much affects the market, if we'll be at this sort of stalemate that nobody will do anything until there is more clarity. When a vaccine is out and on the market and we have a president in the White House and there's some stability, strikes me that's when managements can start making decisions at that level rather than during a time of, you know, real unknowns and disruption of any type politically.
Buybacks did not slow down during 2016. We went through a period from the midpoint of 2015 through the end of 2016. And there was a lot of political volatility. Don't forget, Brexit was a major issue, even for U.S. corporations did a lot of business around the world. And the election going into 16, we were looking for every bit as much volatility as we are this time. It was not different. And buybacks were not
slowed
by the headline and political volatility.
Didn't happen.
So I hope that companies that are generating enormous cash flows from healthcare to technology and everywhere else, I hope that they would not be sitting there waiting on an election outcome to do the right thing in terms of returning capital to shareholders. So I think that that's one of the forces that we've been without,
could come back
with a vengeance.
Yeah.
And that should help us after that initial period of shock when we don't have a president for maybe months.
John, hold your thought real quick. I'll get you on the other side of the break. All right, I promise you I'll do that.
No
Up
problem.
Next, take a look at this mystery chart. It's down 40% this year. Just got a big buy call. Why it could go up 70%. That's right, 70% from here. One of our investment committee members already owns it. We'll tell you about it. We'll debate it in our call of the day coming up next.
Old Dominion Freight Line was built on keeping promises. With an industry-leading on-time delivery record and low claims rate, we keep promises better than any other LTL freight carrier. Because we treat every shipment like it's our most important one, which means we do the little things right so that we can keep our promises and you can keep yours too. That's what drives us. To learn how OD can help your business keep its promises, visit odfl.com. Old Dominion, helping the world keep promises.
All right, welcome back to our conversation in just a moment. First, though, Sue Herrera has the headlines for us. Hi, Sue.
Hello, Scott. Hello, everybody. Here's what's happening at this hour. In Louisville, Kentucky, officials have extended that city's curfew for two more nights after fires were set yesterday. A federal appeals court has overturned a plan to settle opioid cases against drug companies. The plan would have allowed an unprecedented negotiation class of 33,000 cities, towns, and counties to take part in settlement negotiations. Mary Trump, the niece of President Trump, is suing him and two other family members, claiming they cheated her out of tens of millions of dollars and squeezed her out of the family business. And in Finland, researchers are testing coronavirus-sniffing dogs. It is hoped that they will become a cost-effective and quick way of identifying infected travelers. Volunteers rub their skin with a wipe that is then given to the dogs to smell, potentially giving results in under a minute. You are up to date. That's the news update. Scott, back to you.
All right. Appreciate that, Sue. Thank you, Sue Herrera. All right, Doc. Forgive me for not letting you speak when you wanted to. I had to take a quick break, but now the platform is yours before we get to Chevron, which we're showing you now, before we get to Chevron.
I'm agreeing with both Josh and Kerry, Scott, but timing is everything, of course, in trading and so forth. I do think that they are likely to wait. That is, the repurchase of shares is what they were talking about, whether companies will go back to that repurchase and or giving total strangers money in the form of a dividend. I think that is likely to occur, but I think that there's certainly an impetus to wait until they see whether it is President Trump or Vice President Biden, because of the idea that maybe the tax increase under Vice President Biden would be one reason that they would want to accelerate any of that ahead of the calendar year changing, when the tax year changes for most investors. Scott, that was the whole thing I was just going to offer up.
Well, I'm glad you did. Let's talk about Chevron now. Gave our mystery chart away because there it is. The stock year to date is down nearly 41%. Josh mentioned how, you know, people are, in his words, liquidating energy stocks. Jim, you own Chevron. The stock gets initiated today at MKM. $121 is the price target. That's a buy. What's your take on this? Is now a good time to be buying any of these big energy stocks?
I cannot and will not say that today is the day that you need to buy energy stocks. But the longer picture here, you have to ask yourself, do you want to have the market weight in energy? The S&P 500 has 3% in energy, not very much. You might as well take that toehold. And if you're going to do it, please, please use the high quality name that Chevron Texaco is. It's the biggest of the big. It's got the strongest balance sheet. It's acquisitive, picking up the debris from the destruction that's being wrought. And it has a 7% dividend yield. But the first question you have to answer as an investor is, do you want to be at the weighting in the S&P 500, which is 3%? It's not much. That's where I am, and I'm comfortable with it.
So you're not willing to say that now is the time to buy the stock.
I can't give you a catalyst.
Okay. Because, I mean, you were willing to say now is the time to buy Microsoft and Walmart now, but...
I am.
Okay. I mean, because the stock...
I am. Listen, my...
A catalyst alone...
My actions speak louder than my words.
A stock's pull down is not a catalyst alone, is what you're saying, because stock's down more than 18% in a month.
Yeah, it is. And look, I think what you have, I'm going to say this again, third time. The entering argument here is, do you have the weighting in energy as an individual investor that you want to? If you don't, then Chevron is the name to fill out the energy sector. But if you're at your weighting in energy and it's, you know, 3% of the S&P 500, maybe you want to be 4%, maybe you want to be 2%. Look, whatever your energy holding is, it has to include Chevron, is my opinion.
You getting a little snippy with me, Jim?
No, yes. Not at all.
You sounded like my dad when
not,
I was like
Scotty,
12.
Scotty, seriously, not... Oh, sorry. Sorry. No. I'm just being passionate, brother.
All right. Well, I mean, you said you were going to say it for the third time. Like, it didn't get through the other two times.
Scotty, sorry, man. Judge, I love you.
Okay. Just checking. Back at you, Farmer Jim. All right. Carrie, you own Phillips 66. Amy, you own EOG. Doc, you own BP. Josh, you own Schlumberger. Nobody owns Chevron. Amy, why?
We actually own EOG, Schlumberger, and Royal Dutch Shell. The energy stocks are trading together. So you could argue between Chevron or EOG or Schlumberger, but they're all down about the same amount. And when energy comes back, and I think it will, I think the important point, Jim was saying, it's energy is actually less than 3% of the S&P now, down from 16% in 2008. So, you know, the relative underperformance has been unbelievably dramatic, and it's hard to think that there's that much more to go when you're, you know, sub 3% of the S&P at this point. So I don't know the timing of when this will turn around. We have been underweight energy for years. This is the first year since I've been at Chevy Chase Trust that we're now overweight energy. I think the risk reward makes a lot of sense here. You want to be buying things when capital is flowing away from the sector that mathematically makes returns better. And that's been the case for the past 5 years.
There were a couple interesting calls today, too, which I want to get to in the financials space. Goldman Sachs got upgraded today at UBS. Several catalysts, they say, provide a bridge to the benefits from financial targets. Jim, you own Goldman. John, do you own Goldman?
No, I do not, Scott. I don't own Goldman right now. I would own it based on the trading because one of the things that I'm doing right now, Scott, I looked back at the last 22 days of September. On the trading days, my average hold is less than 24 hours. And I suspect that a lot of the traders on the Goldman desk are likewise moving very quickly in and out.
Right.
And the fact that it's moved from 3 days down to less than one tells me that's an acceleration that's going to be good for Goldman Sachs, but I don't own the stock
right
now. So
Josh Brown, Cramer today, this morning, just after 9, said, quote, this is not a compelling buy. He's talking about Wells Fargo, which also was named a fresh pick at Baird. This is not a compelling buy. I don't want to recommend any bank stock for fear of looking like a fool. He said of J.P. Morgan, which you own, Jamie's bank, Jamie Dimon, CEO, is undervalued, but nobody cares. But nobody cares because of the environment you're in. How do you deal with that?
I think Jim Cramer is exactly right. Like, these stocks basically are now being valued as utilities. And if they're utilities, none of their dividends are high enough to justify people getting excited about them. But these were stocks that were supposed to work out wonderfully during the Trump administration. And they were on fire right after that election. Same thing with energy stocks. These are the two worst performing sectors during Trump's presidency, which, by the way, highlights why you don't want to trade or invest based on politics. But what do we do with the banks now? J.P. Morgan is the only one I own. Like, I'm not interested in Goldman. I'm not interested in Wells Fargo. And saying they're cheap over and over again, which you could have done for 10 years, wouldn't have done you any good. So what is the thing that finally makes them start to work? I think you really need curve steepening. But even then, there's this growing sense that these banks are 20th century brands, and the assets they have, branch locations in all these cities around the country, with every passing month are less and less relevant assets. That one times book value, some of them are under one times book value. It's because nobody cares about what the assets are that sit on their books. Now look at PayPal. Mm-hmm. This is like a $200 billion market cap. It's three times bigger than Goldman Sachs. Does anyone even know that? Look at Square. So these are 21st century financial services brands. The fact that neither of those stocks are in the financial index is why the XLF has been such a horrible place to be. If they would have included MasterCard, Visa, PayPal, Square in the financials where they belong, I'm talking to you, Sam Stovall, then investing in financials wouldn't have been as moribund as it's been. So I don't know what changes that. I'm long J.P. Morgan. I think from a total return perspective, I'll do well. Good dividend, good buyback. But I'm at a loss. I don't know what makes these stocks outperform the market anytime soon.
Putting Sam on notice. Square, by the way, did get upgraded today as well. Outperform. That is from Perform over at Oppenheimer. Price target established there at $185. We showed you the chart. Josh was talking about it. Doc owns calls as well. Speaking of John Najarian, he has unusual activity today. It's up next. And a reminder, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. We're back on the Half right after this.
The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric
ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com. The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tasty Trade. Tasty Trade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tasty Trade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
We're back. Unusual activity time in Skechers. John Najarian, tell us what you're seeing.
All right, Scott. Well, we see November calls. So two expirations, two big expirations out into the future. The 37 strike is what they're buying, Scott. They bought a lot of those very quickly like that for about 60 cents. I bought those calls. I'll probably be in these for about a month. Second one, Qualcomm, QCOM. They were with the stock at about 111.40. They were buying calls in here, Scott, the 115 calls that expire next week, not this Friday, the following Friday. I'll probably be in those close to 7 days, Scott. And as always, those are deep end of the pool. Very fast expiration. That means time decay, so be careful.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you for that, John Najarian. All right, we're ready to answer your questions next. Ask Halftime coming up, and you still have time to reach us. Send your questions in by video as well. I look forward to that. We'll play it on the air. You can email us, askhalftime@cnbc.com. We will be right back. Oh, time now to answer your questions. First up, a video question for you, Josh.
Hi, my name is Derek Shagwar from Houston, Texas. My question is regarding Slack Technologies. Ticker is work. I hadn't seen much of a run-up relative to the other growth stocks. So my question is now a good time to get in this stock, or should I wait and jump in later? Thank you.
Josh?
Oh, I didn't know if you were going to toss it back to me. I am out of Slack. I had been in it for a while. It was one of the worst performing software names in the whole market. I could have thrown a dart and probably ended up picking five or six other names that doubled during the time period that I held it. So it was a big mistake by me. I think it's a phenomenal product. I love the company. I'm a very passionate customer of the service, but that doesn't always make for a good investment. I may end up back in the stock at some point, but I have no plans to rebuy it now.
Okay. Thank you for that. Jim, quickly to you. Mike in Chicago, I bought Viacom in May. Should I add more here?
So Mike, look, I think Viacom is going to be in the high 30s by the end of the year, just on the basis of the streaming business alone, which gets no respect from the street. So look for that. On the other hand, for you, Mike, just for you, you bought in May, you're up a double. You might trim a little bit. That's just because you did such a good job buying. But otherwise, I'm long. I'm not selling.
Okay, Carrie, to you, Oz in Louisiana. What do you think of the prospects for Alibaba?
We like Alibaba. It's the dominant e-commerce player in China. China's growing again. We think that they've got investments in many different areas, and we like the stock.
Okay. Keep your questions coming, please. We will play them on the air. Send them to AskHalftimeCNBC.com. More trades straight ahead on the half. And Delivering Alpha, it's back. It's our 10th anniversary, too. September 30th, that's next week. Mary Erdos, Carla Harris, Chamath Palihapitiya, many more. To learn more and register, go to deliveringalpha.com. We're back in just 2 minutes. Back on the half, time for the futures outlook. Yields on the 10-year Treasury note moving lower today. There you go right there, 66 basis points this week. Joining us, Brian Stutland of Equity Armor Investments, TJM's Jim Urio. Jim, where are we going next?
Okay, well, if the Fed wanted zero rates, I think we would have had zero rates by now. So I think any trades for lower rates in the short term are fine, but medium and longer term, we're not comfortable with that in the 10-year. I think right now we are going to test the low of that channel we've had for the last 6 months, which is approximately 0.55 to 0.80. So I think in the near term, 0.55 is doable. I do think as soon as the stock market gets through whatever it's going through right now, I do believe in the medium and longer term, we're going to steepen the curve. And I think I want to see a trade above 0.8. To me, will indicate that it's out of that channel. At that point in time, I think the curve will steepen. But I think lower rates in the near term.
Yeah, Brian, I mean, even when the market was going up, rates weren't exactly moving like gangbusters. So what do you think?
Well, I think when you took a look at it, you know, I think there's a couple defined support areas where the Federal Reserve was clearly in the game bidding up treasuries. And if you look at the 10-year note futures, is what we trade here on Futures Outlook, there's a couple areas where you found support a little bit lower from here where they bid it up. So even though the market rallied, it seemed the Fed was there to also buy treasuries as well. And to Urio's point, we're still in this up channel in the futures market here, but obviously interest rates headed lower. The 0.55 interest rate is probably a level I also agree with that I'd like to see us touch or at least break through that 80 basis points on the up end here. And after we break there, it'll be interesting if the Fed then steps back in. If you see the 10-year get back to 1%, if they step back in and support the market there, even if we were to get some sort of stock market rally, if that sort of holds steady there. So I would want to see a significant decline in 10 years before I'm totally out of the picture here. Until then, I still think it's a good area to have in your portfolio, 10-20% holding in somebody that wants to be aggressive in the markets, because it is a little wonky right now what's going on in the stock market. There's going to be a lot of sloshing around back and forth, and at least 10 years provide a little bit of protection in that sense.
All right, guys, thank you. Good stuff. Brian Stutland, Jim Urio. Final trades straight ahead.
Miss the show? Don't sweat it. The Halftime Report now has a podcast. Market-moving interviews, call of the day, unusual activity, and, of course, Ask Halftime. Look for us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcasting app and subscribe to the Halftime Pod today.
All right, we're back. We'll do final trades in just a second. John Najarian, though, tell me about these S&P calls that you bought.
Well, Scott, as you know, we follow in fast money when it shows up on calls or puts. This one was calls. Today, with the market near the lows, they came piling into the S&P 500. They were buying the 325 calls. Then they rolled up and bought the 330 calls that expire next week, Scott. So it's a very distinct amount of time that they wanted, at least 1 week of coverage with the index at 321, 322, I think. They were buying the 330 calls, so $7 or $8 out of the money. Bought 20,000 of them, almost just like bang, that fast. I followed in on those, Scott. I'll probably be in those till Wednesday or Thursday next week.
These Nikola puts you have gone, right? Cashed out?
Yep. Capped out. These were calls that were going to, or puts rather, that were going to be expiring anyway. So as the stock fell, those puts went deeper and deeper in the money, Scott. I was lucky enough to be in them for the last 3 weeks, and it certainly paid off as the stock's just been hammered over the past, five trading sessions.
Wow, we're showing, I don't know if you can see where you're sitting, but we're showing a 1 week. I mean, down 40% to your point in a week. John, thank you for that. Carrie, how about a final trade?
Crazy. Thank you.
So I'm going to give you a new one. It's Fortive, FTV. Fortive is a diversified industrial that was spun out of Danaher a few years ago. It sells at a discount to its peers. And they produce instruments, high-precision controls, sensors, and all sorts of measurements for healthcare, machinery, and technology and logistics.
Okay. Good stuff. Amy?
We like Illumina. We think the recent weakness from the Grail acquisition gives you a unique opportunity to buy this market winner. So we really like it here.
All right, good stuff. Farmer Jim.
Disney, they're reopening Disney Hong Kong over the weekend. Those reopenings have been a catalyst in the past few months.
Right.
Good entry point here.
TRB.
Stewart Information Systems, STC, 3% dividend yield, 9x earnings. Real estate play. I love it.
Doc Quick.
We bought LVS during the show, Scott.
Okay.
LVS,
right,
Las Vegas Sands.
Thanks, everybody. The exchange is now.
Thank you.
You've been listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast. You can always catch us live weekdays at 12 Eastern, only on CNBC.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.